The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Martin Philip left Fayetteville in the late 1980s. Since then, there has been opera singing, banjo playing, a career in finance in New York City, baking, and writing. The baking has led to his position as head baker at King Arthur Flour in Vermont, and the writing allowed him to create Breaking Bread, A Baker's Journey in 75 Recipes. He'll be at Sunday's Books in Bloom in Eureka Springs, and he'll be with us later this hour. In about an hour on 91.3, on NPR's Here and Now, a review of President Trump's administration's foreign policy initiatives, including the U.S. Embassy move to Jerusalem and the withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. This conversation will be with former Secretary of Defense and former CIA Director Leon Panetta. That, plus the afternoon's news, on today's Here and Now, beginning at 1, right after Ozarks at Large. And the third annual Chancellor and New Faculty bus tour of Arkansas began earlier today. Chancellor Joseph Steinmetz and other university officials are traveling south this afternoon, eventually stopping in Hot Springs and Monticello. Other stops this week include McGee, Roer, Dumas, Pine Bluff, Little Rock, and Clarksville. Bus travel is a holdover from the previous century, and we begin this afternoon's Ozarks with a very 21st century topic. The city of Fayetteville is working to improve equitable access to digital services and programs. As part of its digital inclusion plan, the mayor created a task force earlier this year that includes representatives from the city, the University of Arkansas, the Fayetteville Public Library, and the Fayetteville Public School District. The task force is kicking off its public input phase Thursday with events at the Farmers Market and the Public Library. Michelle Gibeau, chairwoman of the task force, came to Studio 123 last week to speak with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about the initiative. Gibeau says she became involved because of research she was conducting as an English and communication librarian at the University of Arkansas.
I was doing research. So as an academic librarian, a faculty academic librarian, I'm involved in doing both service work and research, as well as the teaching that I do, you know, for students about how to do research. So some of my own research involved sort of access to the internet. And I was interested in grassroots organizations that are looking at building, you know, sort of partnerships to get broadband access. And so a colleague and I were going to be doing a presentation for the Digital Library Federation Forum. One of the groups that I was interested in looking into is something called Next Century Cities, which is what the mayor of Fayetteville has gotten us involved in. So I contacted Susan Norton at the city, and I asked her, what can you tell me about Next Century Cities? And so we had a great meeting, and we found out we had a lot of common interests. And she said, the mayor is planning to do a task force to study broadband, and wouldn't you be interested in being involved? And I said, of course. And so then after that, next thing I know, I've been asked to chair it. And so it's something that I'm putting a lot of effort into because it's really an exciting thing for Fayetteville.
So what prompted the city to start this task force and investigate this issue further?
So I think there are a lot of different ways to look at that question. The first thing is to remember that this is a huge issue. Access to the internet is a huge issue that really should be much more of an election issue. It's something that's sort of a bipartisan concern. Whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent, access to the internet matters a lot if you want to be an entrepreneur or a student or any activity in the 21st century really is dependent on the internet. So this is something that will become, in an information society, becomes a huge issue. So that's one reason. The other reason is that as part of Next Century Cities and the rating system for Fayetteville, having a digital inclusion plan makes us qualify for like being a four or five-star city. I can't remember which it is. But so having a digital inclusion plan in place will also help Fayetteville grow on the national and international map as a community.
And maybe we should define this just for listeners, because I think sometimes people have different definitions. But what do we mean when we're saying digital inclusion or digital equity?
Thank you. Yeah, that's really important. And to me, in particular, as a librarian, you know, one of the things we do, we argue about words endlessly. And so the idea is that digital equity is like any other kind of equity where no one is excluded. Digital inclusion is how you get there. So you basically identify who's being excluded and what do we do about it. So really all of these words, digital inclusion, digital equity, what they mean truly is having access to the internet and also access to the hardware and the skills to use it. So it's the reason it's such a big and unwieldy concept is because it really does involve the quality of access, availability of access, hardware, and digital literacy skills. And if you bundle all those together, that's really what people are talking about when they think about digital inclusion and digital equity.
And in Arkansas, the governor has discussed and worked on, you know, expanding broadband access, especially to rural areas, because that is an issue. I think perhaps some people may be surprised to think that there is inequity just because of how easy it is to, say, get the internet on your phone. And everybody has a phone, of course, right? So mm-hmm. I imagine part of this task force or is part of this task force simply, you know, bringing awareness to the issue?
I would say that that is definitely part of it. I think, though, that it's really important for people who have access to fixed internet that is reliable consider what it might be like to do everything they do on their desktop computer on their phone. Or consider what it might be like to live out in a rural area where all you have is access to a satellite internet that might be affected by the weather. Once you start to imagine that kind of thing and really realize what it means to participate, which means upload speeds as well as download speeds, it really becomes important to be thoughtful about why it might be important to be more inclusive, to make sure that a lot of people have that kind of access.
In Fayetteville schools, the public school district is part of this task force as well. Have you found just in your initial discussions that there's an issue with children having access and being able to do their homework?
Of course. It's known as the homework gap. And one of the things that I think is really important is you hear people talking about the quote-unquote digital divide, like it's a singular thing. But really, it's many different kinds of divides. You know, the kinds of divides that school children experience when they're not able to do their homework are different than the kinds that people who don't have computer skills who want a new job experience, for example. So the homework gap is a big one for me because as an educator, the quality and availability of internet access for, you know, school children is going to affect me down the line when I try and teach them as college students, which is one of the reasons I'm involved.
So what are some of the goals of the task force? I know it's still new and still kind of getting going. We're going to start with roping the public in more soon. But what are some of the goals of the group?
So I think the broadest way to think about it is that we trust that Fayetteville is a community where we have many citizens and residents who will be willing to tell us what they need and what they're concerned about. And so basically, our major goal is to find out what the issues are, what people think is important, what we should focus on. That's basically, you know, sort of the first thing I want to do. And I don't want to privilege anything beyond that, but I can tell you what I think will happen. What I think will happen is that we'll find that our community is experiencing a lot of the things that other communities have noticed, and that what we will need to do is build a coalition of people who are interested in basically solving the problems of exclusion. And I think what we'll do is we'll create a plan that will involve basically creating this coalition, and our strategic planning process will involve making a plan for holding on to this kind of cohesiveness and alignment that will happen as we start to talk about these issues. So the plan is to develop, you know, sort of a way of talking about these issues and find out who's interested. And then the long term is to kind of keep these kinds of activities and projects bubbling.
So the public input portion of this plan will start on Thursday. You guys are having a kickoff at the farmers market, and then you're having an event in the evening at the Fayetteville Public Library, and you'll have a guest speaker. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes. Joanne Hovis is an expert in building broadband public and private partnerships. She's a lawyer. She was educated at the University of Chicago. She's involved in the Coalition for Local Internet Choice, CLIC. So she's going to be an excellent speaker to kind of help us think about what it might be to think about access to broadband and think about how to build partnerships that are public and private, not just necessarily around broadband itself, but also around hardware, also around digital literacy issues. And so what is a broadband public-private partnership, or what is a public-private partnership? You hear that a lot. And I was kind of thinking about that as I was driving here to talk to you, and it reminded me of something that recently came up in the last couple of weeks. Jeff Bezos, who is the richest man in the world and the most successful entrepreneur, recently did an interview, and he rarely does interviews.
Owner of Amazon.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that he said was that as growing up, he was a child of teenage parents, one of whom was a Cuban immigrant. One of the things he mentioned was that when he was in fourth grade, he had access to a teletype, which is sort of a former computer. This would be in like 1970. And some business in Houston was paying for access for that computer to do computing. So you would use a modem over the phone line. And what was interesting is that nobody in the school knew how to use it. And so Jeff Bezos and his fourth grade friend figured it out. And that whole infrastructure right there is an example of a public-private partnership. Like basically a public school and some business in Houston partnering to make it possible for a future entrepreneur to use a computer. That's what that is. So that's ultimately what this task force is trying to do, is to set up those kinds of partnerships so that, you know, the next entrepreneur can be from Arkansas.
And those private, public-private partnerships could help perhaps in the situation of cost, because cost can definitely be a barrier to accessing broadband.
Yes, you're right. Absolutely. So that's the idea, is that, you know, the whole American prospect is built on the idea of competition. And when you don't have competition or you don't have meaningful competition, then that actually makes it difficult for people to access things that they truly need. And so that will be one of the conversations that I think people want to have.
So at Thursday's event, there will be a speaker. Will there be a chance for the audience to ask questions or to have input?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
That's the whole point. You know, we really would like to. The whole idea is to bring in a member, somebody that we respect and know will help us to help begin these conversations. And so that's really the whole point, is that people attend and ask questions. And we do recognize that Fayetteville High School is having their graduation on that night. And so what I do want to alert people to is the fact that we realize that we didn't plan it that way, but what it's going to mean is that this is the beginning of a conversation that other people who won't be able to attend, we will include you down the line, we promise.
I imagine there will be more things like this that will be organized in the future.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I want to do is plug our website, because we have a lot of resources that you know, you can use online if you have access. And then also we will be having, you know, materials that are available in print at the public library as well as other locations.
And so what is that website?
Fayetteville-AR.gov. And then over on the left-hand side, you'll see the master plans. And if you click on that, you'll see the digital inclusion plan. And all of our materials, including our meeting minutes and everything, that will be added to that as we move forward.
And on the website right now, you guys have a timeline so people can see that ultimately what you're hoping to do with this is create a plan that you'll present to the City Council in January.
That's the plan.
That's the plan.
I look forward to it.
That was Michelle Gibeau, chairwoman of the Fayetteville Digital Inclusion Task Force, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda inside the Carver Center for Public Radio last week. Thursday's presentation at the Fayetteville Public Library begins at 6 o'clock. It's free, and it's open to the public.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 13th Annual Books in Bloom Literary Festival, produced by the Carroll and Madison Public Library Foundation, will be held Sunday, May 20th from noon to 5 p.m. at the 1886 Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs. The foundation welcomes authors Deborah Crombie, Marcus Sakey, Lisa C., and others. Information regarding this free literary festival available at booksinbloom.org.
Ahead on Ozarks, voters are deciding a state Supreme Court race this year, and the primary contest has attracted attention and money. Dark money.
does the Arkansas electorate, particularly in a judge's race where they don't know a lot of issues, do they remain pliable to these kinds of attacks? Well, there's an old school of thought that if you get hit this viciously, this smeared this much, it works. Or is there indeed a backlash?
John Brummett, a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, considers the influence of money on judicial campaigns. That's ahead on today's Ozarks at Large. Regular airmail service began 100 years ago today. The United States Postal Service says it was May 15, 1918, when a small group of Army pilots delivered mail along a route that included Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and New York City. A commemorative forever stamp honoring the century of regular airmail service was issued earlier today. Keyword here, regular. Mail had been delivered by air, if sporadically, before May 1918. In fact, the National Postal Museum, a branch of the Smithsonian, has a picture in its collection of, quote, an aeroplane delivery of mail to Fort Smith that was made in November 1911. The caption on the photo indicates the pilot of the plane, and the plane looks like an offspring of a bicycle and a biplane. The pilot was Lincoln Beachy, and the postmaster at the time was F.M. Baumgartner. The caption informs that the 1911 flight successfully delivered 25,000 pieces of mail from League Park Station to the Fort Smith Post Office. And if you'd like to see that photograph from the National Postal Museum, we have a link to it at today's OzarksAtLarge.com entry. Also there at OzarksAtLarge.com, past editions of our show, past individual interviews, and stories that you can share with friends through email and social media. This is Ozarks at Large.
KUAF is supported by contributing listeners and by KUAF's sustaining members. KUAF sustaining members automatically support this public radio station, and that reliable support helps 91.3 be able to plan and grow into the future. From all of us here at KUAF, thank you to all of our sustaining members. We appreciate your support.
This is 91.3, your public radio station, for 33 years. Thanks for your support. Don Strike, a clinical social worker, thinks about humor professionally. Later this month, on the 24th, he'll lead a workshop about the use of humor in treatment. The session at the Jones Center in Springdale is sponsored by the Association of Northwest Arkansas Medical Social Workers. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently talked with Don Strite, and she has this report.
Psychotherapist Don Strite helps individuals in crisis using a variety of methods, including humor. Strite, a retired professor of social work, taught graduate students at the University of Arkansas Little Rock and Fayetteville campuses. He currently has a private practice based in Little Rock and travels delivering workshops to counselors and therapists on applied humor in psychotherapy. Humor, he says, has a documented physiological effect.
When we laugh, natural killer cells, which destroy tumors and viruses, increase along with gamma interferon, which is a disease-fighting protein, T cells, important for our immune system, and B as in boy, B cells, which make disease-fighting antibiotics. Laughter decreases glucose levels in diabetics. It increases breathing, increases oxygen use, short-term changes in hormones, and it increases endorphins, neurotransmitters, and it increases the heart rate. And there's a release of dopamine. It heightens a sense of having a positive outlook. It really does help a person feel more of a sense of well-being.
But injecting humor into intensive therapy sessions, Strite says, has to be strategic. In his workshop, Strite provides a disclaimer.
I just say this workshop intends to offer the use of humor as another resource for therapeutic treatment. Now, some dangers include offensiveness, invalidation of a client's trauma, reduced credibility, and impediments to healing. And a reality is there are some things that will never be experienced as, quote, funny. And one of the things that I, an exercise or reflection that I have participants work with is I ask them, have you ever experienced anything that at an earlier time was a very painful experience, serious loss, for example, that you consider to be tragic, but now, after some time has passed, that now it becomes a, quote, funny or humorous story that you tell. And then I ask them, and oftentimes participants will say, yeah, I had that. And I'll ask the question, well, what changed? What happened? You know, of the same event that now is something that's a, quote, funny story. So we have to be careful about using humor.
At his workshop, Streit likes to cite Norman Cousins, a political journalist and author who discovered the role of laughter in treating his own debilitating disease.
And he wrote a book called Anatomy of an Illness. And in that, he speaks about how he holed up in a hotel room with a supposedly terminal illness. He watched funny movies, and he found out, incidentally, that whenever he laughed a lot, it reduced his pain, and eventually it put his disease into remission. He's kind of a classic example.
Streit, who uses cognitive behavioral therapy primarily in his practice, teaches that finding humor in human failings is valuable.
For example, I asked participants in the beginning, before I start the material, I say, how many of you ever texted the wrong person? And inevitably, at least half of them have. And then I'll ask the question, was that a, quote, funny laughable, or was that a, quote, funny, uncomfortable, ironic situation that you had to deal with? So humor is just there. It's running in life all the time. And let me give you one more example, if I may. And the example is that this man, he and his wife have a dog named Danger. And he was in charge of watching Danger, and Danger got out. And so he was freaking out. And what he did was he drove around the neighborhood with the windows down in his car, yelling, "Danger, danger," like the sky is falling. So the benefit of using laughter is that it helps people realize that when they're in a crisis, that they are not suffering alone, and that there are other people there who also go through suffering, and that they do it together.
Don Streit will deliver his workshop May 24th at the Jones Center for Families, room 206, from 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. The cost is $45. Continuing education unit credits are offered to professionals. The public, he says, is also welcome to attend. To register, contact Don Streit, S-T-R-E-I-T, on Facebook. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And comedy is the idea this Friday night at Stage 18. The next installment of the comedy trivia game show, Dunst, is scheduled for 8:30 Friday night at Stage 18. Audience members get to test their trivia knowledge against a panel of, well, it says comedians, but I've been invited to be on this month's panel, so it's a loose definition, apparently. I promise few intentional laughs, but my answers might provide some unintentional humor. Dunst, a live trivial comedy, begins at 8:30 Friday night at Stage 18 in downtown Fayetteville. It's hosted by Troy Giddings. You can learn more at the Comedians NWA Facebook page.
For over 23 years, Community Clinic has served as the medical home for thousands of our neighbors in Northwest Arkansas, providing health care in 14 locations, including Springdale, Rogers, Siloam Springs, Fayetteville, Lincoln, and Prairie Grove. Healthy people, healthy community. Community Clinic, NWA.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Martin Phillip is the sort of person it's hard to describe briefly. He's an Ozarks native and former Fayetteville resident. He's sung opera, he's had a career in finance in New York City, he plays the banjo, and he's highly regarded as a baker. He's now the head baker at King Arthur Flour in Vermont, and he has won some of the most prestigious baking awards and competitions in the world. He's also an author. His book, Breaking Bread, A Baker's Journey Home in 75 Recipes, published by HarperCollins, was recently awarded the grand prize at the New England Book Festival. This weekend, he'll return to the Arkansas Ozarks for the annual Books in Bloom Literary Festival in Eureka Springs. The festival brings in several writers from all types of writing as a fundraiser for the Carroll and Madison Public Library Foundation. Late last week, we reached Martin Phillip in Vermont and asked him a few questions about baking and about writing, and maybe a question or two about banjoing. Despite a career that's taken him far from the Ozarks, he says you can easily find the Ozarks in the essays and recipes in Breaking Bread, A Baker's Journey Home in 75 Recipes.
No, they can't. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's like I'll always be a transplant. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's just how it is. And I think that's fine. I'm happy with that. I'm proud of that. It's a strong flavor. I was raised around strong flavors, and I don't just mean that in terms of like the palate. I mean, red dirt and sassafras, you know, tumble down log cabins, springs covered with iron, steel corrugate, you know, those are discarded, broken, you know, dish remnants in a junk pile in the back of the house. You know, those are things that you don't lose the taste for, or, you know, an auction, someone calling an auction. It's just, those are things that, that's capital, you know, not something I would ever spend.
You know, I something that novice or people who work in the kitchen but just for themselves sometimes hear is that, you know, with cooking, you can experiment here and there, but with baking, it's much more precise. And I wonder, in the world of King Arthur flour and of bread, how much experimentation can you / should you do?
Yeah, that's a great question. And even the fact that you know that speaks volumes of the fact that you know what the heck is going on, because a lot of people don't know that baking is not cooking. You know, baking, like the person who's an engineer by day often makes a great baker by night because they have this sort of ability to follow instructions and not deviate too much. So when you're at the inception of your process, or when you're trying something new in the baking realm, I always encourage people to, you know, be a good scientist, follow the directions at least once. And then once you have a foundation built, once you have been making scones for a while, you can begin to do some experimentation, moving with small steps, swapping things. Like if you're making a scone with chopped figs in it, well, you could substitute one for one dried apricots or dried blueberries or maybe even dried apple soaked in rum. You know, you can begin to add these improvisational items into what it is that you do, but you have to start from a scientific basis, which is different than the improvisational, you know, Martha Graham dance that I always sort of say, you know, cooking is. Cooking is like an improvisation where you begin and you decide halfway across the room whether you're going to do another spin or whatever it is that you do. I'm not a dancer, but does that make sense? You know, you,
absolutely.
It's much more of an improvisation to cook than to bake. But with time and with experience and with sort of empirical knowledge, the knowledge gained from experience, you can move into realms of doing some improvisation and writing your own recipes. And a lot of the goal of the book was to give people the foundations upon which they could build their own sort of bread experience, write their own bread narrative.
You have been involved in I guess what you would call, you know, sort of competitions or where things are awarded.
Yep.
And if you run a race in the Olympics, it's who's first. You know, there's nothing subjective. If you're playing lacrosse or baseball, it's who scores the most.
Yep.
What's it like competing in something that is subjective and it's somebody's ultimate and a very knowledgeable, a very learned opinion, but it's ultimately an opinion?
Yeah, it's tough. It's much more like figure skating. That's what I would say. It's like, and even though it seems like, you know, with the Olympics now, figure skating is much more sort of quantified than it was when you and I were younger and watching the Soviet judge at that point or whatever it was,
right.
You know. Not giving the scores that the sort of like Western Alliance judges would give, because there was much more that was left to interpretation. So it's tough because it is subjective. You know, flavor is subjective. Visual quality is subjective. There are aspects within the competition that are not subjective. So when your baguettes come out of the oven, they weigh them and they have to be, you know, within 10 grams above or below. So five grams below or 5 grams above the target weight of 250 grams. They have to be within between 54 and 56 centimeters. And so there are things like that which are quantified and measurable. But at the end of the day, there's still this sort of, you know, qualitative, this sort of subjective quality to it that is rewarding if you're the winner and, you know,
right.
You feel pretty dejected if you're not. But for me, I never entered one of those. I wouldn't say that I didn't hope to win, but I would say that I tried to always keep at the forefront of my mind, as an objective, my own improvement, challenging myself in a way that would force me to be better than I was when I began the process of preparation, which I think is, at least for me, the purpose of doing any of that. And I would even include, like, you know, running races or mountain bike races, whatever else it is that I've decided to pursue at a competitive level. It's only ever been because I knew that if I said I was going to run a 50-mile race, that I would have to run, you know, 30-mile long runs, and I wouldn't do that just for fun.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, no, there is what, a carrot at the end of the stick, or I'm not sure that's the right metaphor. But
no, it's absolutely the right one. But for me, the carrot was always skills. That was only ever sort of carrot that was in place for me. It was just skills because if you want to get better, it's like, you know, tell everyone that you're going to write a book, you know. Don't start writing it, but tell everyone you're going to write it, and, you know, and then you're going to have to write it, and I guarantee you, you'll be a better writer by the end. You may have less hair, but you'll get it done.
I'm talking with Martin Philip. He is the author of Breaking Bread, A Baker's Journey Home in 75 Recipes, head baker at King Arthur Flour. He'll be at Books in Bloom in Eureka Springs on May 20th. I love the cover of the book. It's beautiful. Was there any difficulty deciding which piece of bread you were going to hold?
It's an awesome question. You got lots of good ones, Kyle. So that was a funny story. The first iteration of the cover came, and it was a good shot, taken over my shoulder looking down, and I was stretching some bagels. And I liked the shot a lot, but for me, it didn't have any resonance. It didn't speak to the craft enough. It was too product specific. And fortunately, HarperCollins publisher, they get to choose the cover. They also get to name the book. And they came back and said, you know what, we think that we want you on the cover. And I thought, that's not necessarily the improvement I was looking for. But we did go out and we did schedule another day to shoot the cover. And I got lucky. It was a Friday, and I was in the bakery, and I was literally walking by as a baker was loading these large rounds, these 2 kilo rounds. That's 2 kilos, like 4.5 pounds. So these big rounds, and I said, hey, can I score one of those? And scoring is the last thing that happens before bread goes into the oven. We take a razor blade and we can cut decorative marks, which are actually functional as well as decorative. And so I cut one of them, and a loaf came out, and it looks good. And I said, yeah, I'm going to take that to this shoot that we're doing today. And we were shooting outside in my friend's sugar house, and it was, I'm not kidding, it was 4 degrees, as in, you know, negative whatever, negative 28, I guess, 28 below zero. It was so cold that I had to hold my breath every time the photographer took a shot.
Oh, my gosh.
It was pretty funny. But that loaf, we had others that day. We had some smaller ones. We had long, skinny ones. We had all these different ones. But that one just seemed to sort of sum it up. And when the proofs came back, there wasn't a lot of hemming and hawing. Everybody, the publisher just said, yep, let's do this. That's the one. And I love that loaf. It's made with over 50% freshly milled flour. We have a small mill in the bakery where we're able to source local grains and then mill them ourselves and bake with them, which is a sort of great shortened view of the process that we make, says it sort of transforms from inedible to loaf.
Do you still play the banjo?
All the time, man. All the time. In fact,
I'll play at Books and Bloom. I'll play some. I take it everywhere. I played at the Arkansas Literary Festival. I played at the events I did in Fayetteville in Northwest Arkansas when I was back in March. So it's like an extension of my arm at this point, which is a good time.
There's banjo in your past, and your present. There's opera, there's writing, there's baking. Are you a multitasker, or do you concentrate on one thing at once and then move to the next?
I think that for me, it's a matter of just doing things that I find gratifying. You know, it's really that simple. And I find that, I don't know, there are just a lot of hours in the day. And if you ignore all the chores and just focus on the good stuff, there's even more time. So I guess I do some juggling. I do a fair amount of juggling. I was able, in working on the book, to sort of, at least for the first part, really try and confine my work to just a couple days a week. And then once the heat got turned up, I had to work, you know, almost daily. And then I've got a full-time job and three kids, and I guess I'm just making it all fit like everybody else, you know.
Martin Phillip is the head baker at King Arthur Flour and the author of Breaking Bread, A Baker's Journey Home in 75 Recipes. He'll be at the Books in Bloom Literary Festival Sunday afternoon from noon to 5 in Eureka Springs, along with several other writers. You can find out more about Martin, a former Fayetteville resident and Ozarks native, at breadwrite.com. And you can see the entire schedule for Sunday's Books in Bloom at booksinbloom.org. Voting continues in Arkansas ahead of the official election date of May 22nd for party primary preferences and for nonpartisan judicial choices, including a chance to make a selection for the Arkansas Supreme Court. Judicial races are nonpartisan in Arkansas. Candidates offer no official party affiliation. That does not make the campaigns immune from some of the seedier aspects of politics, though. This week, Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, sat down with John Brummett, a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, to talk about dark money used to campaign for and against specific judicial candidates.
Judge Kenneth Hickson, you've got Justice Courtney Goodson, and you've got David Sterling, the challenger here. We've seen dark money playing in the Goodson race 2 years ago, and now we've seen it heavily this year. Judge Hickson has the Judicial Crisis Network going after him now.
There's a strange dynamic at play here. Courtney Goodson was the victim of dark money criticism from an outfit calling itself the Judicial Crisis Network, which I can best describe as an ultra-right group that gets favorably cited on Breitbart. And
because the judicial network is in crisis these
days. Apparently. I sense a backlash coming against dark money. I think, from what I just generally hear, people think that outside groups are telling lies or making exaggerated charges. And I thought Goodson was emerging as the vehicle for the backlash. The candidate whom I have actually preferred in my columns, Kenneth Hickson, a judge on the Court of Appeals, this morning happily announces, hey, they hit me too. This is a new kind of a Me Too movement. They hit me too.
Okay.
And there's a Judicial Crisis Network is up somewhere. I've only seen a digital presentation of it with a link, with an ad finding some old case that he ruled on as a Court of Appeals judge in which a criminal conviction involving a crime against a child was overturned, citing a judge using a technicality, has a child running away from a menacing-looking gentleman. And Hickson is out with news releases decrying that, and what that seems to say, among other things, is that the one that this ultra-right conservative Judicial Crisis Network, the one it wants is the one they haven't attacked, meaning David Sterling, who you might remember was a conservative alternative to the very conservative Leslie Rutledge in the Republican Attorney General's primary 2 years ago.
So
Four years ago.
And she was the victim of Judicial Crisis Network advertising.
I think Judicial Crisis Network tried to say she was tied to Barack Obama, which is utterly laughable. Now, it will be interesting to see, does the Arkansas electorate, particularly in a judge's race where they don't know a lot of issues, do they remain pliable to these kinds of attacks? Well, there's an old school of thought that if you get hit this viciously, this smeared this much, it works. Or is there indeed a backlash? And will the backlash sort of spread itself among the other two alternatives, and will it harm Sterling? I'm not prepared to say that's going to happen, but I mean, you just walk around town and people, and the people with whom...
But there's a reason why smear ads still are on air, and it is because they work.
That's what I just said.
And until the backlash
Of Arkansas have a chance if they'll wake up and pay attention and look at what's happening here and consider this, they have a chance to send a message, and we shall see. Courtney Goodson, I've criticized her a lot, but this ad manages to find bases on which not to criticize her and criticizes her. And then to say that the old tactic of finding a judge's ruling in which there was a legal argument necessitating an overturning of a criminal conviction, and then accuse that judge of turning, it's a Willie Horton type thing.
Yeah. And it's been done in the past.
It's been done a lot.
Races,
it's so. Tried and true. It works. I'm hoping this time this thing I'm hearing, this percolation, will actually manifest itself in the polls. That we will see if the people of Arkansas can send a message, and we'll see.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and he writes about dark money in today's paper. You can also find his columns at ArkansasOnline.com. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. And there is more from their conversation and more Arkansas news at talkbusiness.net.
The 23rd annual Greening of the Garden Gala at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks is Friday, May 18th. It begins at 6 p.m. Garden-inspired dishes, silent and live auctions, and live jazz music are all part of this spring celebration. Proceeds support the Botanical Garden's educational programs and services. Tickets are limited. bgozarks.org for more. KUAF is giving away general admission wristbands to Rocklahoma 2018, May 25th through the 27th in Pryor, Oklahoma. Over 60 rock acts will perform, including Godsmack, Stone Temple Pilots, Diamond Head, and The Cult. Winners announced Friday, May 18th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information at KUAF.com.
You may recall late last week we told you about the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum's upcoming lawn social that will serve as a benefit for the landscaping at that museum. Consider this a reminder. It takes place at the Ram in downtown Fort Smith on Saturday. Looking further ahead, the Art Museum is thinking summer and summer classes, camps, and workshops. Earlier this month, while at the Ram, we talked with Delana Vaughn, the education director at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum. She told us then that the summer programming starts early, as in with toddlers.
For kids ages 18 months to 4 years, so it's going to be art and music. And it's more just to get the kids interested, the babies interested in art. We're going to do classical music with them. And, you know, the parachute that we all, I know that I did when I was a kid, that you'd sit on the ground and you'd have this parachute and you could go underneath the parachute. So we're going to make sure that we have a schedule every day, teach them primary colors, have them do the parachute, and then we'll do an art lesson with them, whether that be finger painting or, you know, different bubbles, that putting color in bubbles or, you know, whatever. Just something so they can get their minds thinking about art.
That begins May 22nd, a Tuesday. Also on the 22nd, a session for older children called The Cool Days of Summer. Delana Vaughn says this camp will use ice.
And make like sidewalk chalk with ice, have them outside doing...
I'm sorry. You're going to make sidewalk chalk with ice?
Yeah.
Should I know how this is done or that this is...
No, this is a secret. This is a secret.
Okay.
So they'll be able to go out on the patio and use that. We're going to have some outside art for them to do, inside art, depending on like what the weather is, how hot it is. But that age group, you know, they can get a little wet and be all right with it, you know. So And it still teaches them about art and how you can do different things with it.
Before we moved on, just one more question about using ice as part of art on a Fort Smith summer day. It would seem that sort of exercise would have a small window of opportunity.
14 seconds.
It will last about 14 seconds. Okay. So right. This will be early June. So it'll last about 30 seconds.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the plan.
I can find this out.
Yeah, you should definitely come back.
Interrupted.
That's fine. And then we also have Girls Inc. So we're going to do a month with them, and it's called Spirit of the Girl, and it's just art journaling. So we take two groups of them. So we have an age group 5 to 10, and then we have the teenagers that come in because, you know, they're in a different, you know, developmental ages, and they might want to talk about or express different things that they're going through. So art journaling is obviously for healing, or you know, just to teach them how to incorporate art within their own journals that they might currently have. We have an Arts with Grace program, and that's for special needs and elderly. And we have that currently going on, but this will be the first summer that we continue it. We usually just have it in the fall and winter and then take a break spring, summer. But it's been a really big hit, so we're going to continue to do that through the summer.
There are also art camps in mid-June. In the morning, younger children will participate in a camp that will carry the theme of Under the Sea. That will incorporate marine life with art. In the afternoon, high school age campers will use recycling as inspiration.
And so we're taking recycled materials, and they're going to do sculptures with that. They can make dresses. They can make whatever they want. And they work on that sculpture for the entire, you know, 4 days. And then on the 23rd, which is a Saturday, instead of us doing our RAM Saturday, which is another program that we do, we will have an exhibition. So half of the room downstairs will be for the younger kids, and then the other half will be for the older kids. And they just get to show off what they've done, and people can come out and enjoy it.
Elena Vaughn is the education director at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum, and she spent a few minutes with us last week at the museum telling us about what the RAM is offering this summer. You can learn much more about classes, camps, workshops, exhibitions, and other things taking place at the RAM at fsram.org. And this Saturday's Lawn Social at the RAM is from 6 to 9 p.m. at the museum. And we'll have more about art, in fact, more about chalk art, on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. This weekend, the first ever Eureka Springs Chalk Art Festival gets underway. It actually gets away on Thursday. Elaborate works of art created outside that will be seen until that next thunderstorm.
It's all good. I've taken pictures before the rain came.
Okay.
The piece that I sent you pictures of that I did in the neighbor's driveway in Florida got rained on. It's gone. But I still have the pictures.
The fleeting, yet rewarding, exercise of chalk art. Discussed on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF.
And it's the community spotlight on KUAF. Today I have just walked outside of KUAF Public Radio here at 9 South School. And you might hear that sound. That's actually a blowtorch. They're laying down an art installation for Artisphere on the city street, and we're going to talk to the artist that is in charge of this. Let's go. So we're here with Stacy Levy, the artist. What is this? It's part of Artisphere. Let's start there.
It's a full-scale topographical map of School Avenue. So it really gives you a sense of how hilly this topography is. It's something that you kind of forget about until you're walking up the street and you're starting to get really hot and sweaty and wondering, why is this section so much harder to walk up? And it has to do with steepness. And the lines that are out in the street are showing you the elevation change. Okay. Every time you cross a line, you're crossing 1 foot of elevation. So you're either going 1 foot up if you're walking uphill, or you're going 1 foot down if it's downhill.
So if they're kind of stacked closer together, that's going to be really steep?
Exactly. Okay. The closer the lines are, the steeper it is.
Okay.
And that's how you read topography when we turn it into lines. And one of the cool things about mapping is you take a three-dimensional situation, like a hilly surface, and you got to turn it into a flat piece of paper. And how do you depict a mountain going up and down? You depict it with lines getting closer and closer as it goes up or down. And in the flat areas, the lines are very far apart. So I'm kind of drawing the actual shape of the earth onto the city street to give people a sense of the topographical change that the street has, which is pretty intense. I do a lot of wet work. I work a lot with watersheds and streams and historic streams. But in this case, the topography is showing you where the water goes. So when it is wet, it's going to follow the lines of steepness and go downhill. So knowing where your steep parts are is showing you where the water is going to be running very quickly off the surface. And yes, this right at center is kind of a continental divide. And some of this, if it was on the other side of the street, it would be going down into the Spring Street, which is really a creek. And on this side, it's going into it basically a different tributary. So it's interesting to see these micro patterns in your urban grid. The rain can't soak in, and so it has to run along the roads. It also uses the roads just like we do in our cars and on our sidewalks. So it's using the roads. So it's pretty important to know where your rain is going after it comes out of the sky, and that's what this is sort of about too.
Stacy Levy talking about the topographical street art project going on in downtown Fayetteville. She said she hopes the installation will be complete within a week. It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF.
A listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Decatur. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Back tomorrow, noon and 7, with brand new editions of Ozarks at Large. Thanks so much for being with us on this mid-May Tuesday. We will end this show with music that was recorded inside the Carver Center for Public Radio exclusively for Ozarks at Large from Ashton Barbary. She will be playing at Arcega's Depot in Fayetteville tomorrow night beginning at 7. Later this month on the 26th, she will be at Reggie's New York Pizzeria in Bentonville. You can find out more about Ashton, her upcoming gigs, and also her brand new self-titled CD at her Facebook page. You can also find her music at all the usual places like Spotify, iTunes, and the myriad of digital music suppliers. This is the song Cinnamon in My Coffee, recorded for us. Hey, have a great Tuesday. Back tomorrow.
Abby promised not to watch his first bite. Later I learned it was quite safe.
Coffee.